This is Donna of Donna and Honey's Love Motel, and you're listening to WGXC Acra Hudson Catskill 90.7 FM.
You could go there with your family, and you can meet new friends in the library. When you're at the library, you can read lots of books, and you can find any book. There are lots of Dog Man books, which are my favorite books of all. When I go to the library, I read them, and that's why I like the library.
I'm also on a radio show at the library, and there was also a video making workshop that I did, and I did some animation, and I made a lot of new friends, and I laughed a lot, and it was really fun. My main reason of coming here is because it's books. Of course, it's a library. And I really like the wide selection of books. And they have computers and all sorts of stuff. They also recently did a mural painting thing where they painted the computer room in the back. And I got to be a part of that. And it was really fun. It looks really cool now.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. It's midnight. Actually, it's 2 minutes after midnight, or 4 minutes after midnight. And I apologize for the downtime. I was engrossed in what I'm about to read. So what I'm about to read, I'm going to just read without any further commentary. The name of this story, Radicalized. A short story about healthcare and desperation. It's a lengthy tale, so I may not be able to finish it all, in which case I will finish it on the next broadcast, which will be the first, actually the second mid, first Sunday in January of the next year. Anyways, I don't know what that exact date is, and my computer doesn't want to give me any answers. But I'm going to give you some fiction right now. It's called Radicalized, a short story about healthcare and desperation by Cory Doctorow. If you want to read this story on your own, you can go to the American Prospect at prospect.org and check out the December 9th, 2024 issue. Even though this story was published in a collection by Doctorow in 2019, published by Macmillan. The name of the book is also Radicalized. It's a short story collection. And here it is. Radicalized. On Joe Gorman's 36th birthday, his wife Lacey called him 3 times in a row on his cell phone. He was in a meeting with his manager, a vice president, who had rescheduled twice. It had taken 10 days and a latte to the VP's PA to get FaceTime with this guy, so Joe bumped his wife to voicemail 3 times. She was probably calling to wish him a happy birthday or confirm something about the big dinner they were having at his favorite steakhouse that night. "Do you need to get that?" The VP didn't really bother to hide his irritation. "Sorry," Joe said, and made a show of switching his phone off and pocketing it. He went back to his proposal. He'd found a logistics outsourcer who could manage all their returns, which was the most stubbornly expensive line on his division's balance sheet. He'd worked really hard on the proposal, and this VP could make or break it. Within a couple minutes, though, the VP's PA knocked on the door and Joe's heart sank. Someone more important than him must have clobbered his long-sought time slot. But the PA, Gloria, a stylish, middle-aged black woman who had been with the company for longer than either Joe or the VP, spoke to Joe, not her boss. "It's your wife, Joe." His guts roiled. He had never been more angry at Lacey in their 8 years of marriage. She knew that he had this meeting. It was all he'd talked about, when he'd talked at all, when he wasn't sitting at the kitchen table with his laptop working on the proposal. Jesus fucking Christ. Couldn't she handle this stupid restaurant reservation or guest list or whatever on her own? She was a grown woman. It was his birthday, some birthday present. "Sounds like you need to get that," the VP said. He sounded jocular, but there was also a sardonic eye roll in there Joe couldn't miss. Have Gloria set up another time, okay? Gloria gave him a sympathetic look as he hustled out of the office, out into the parking lot, where it was blazing hot and blindingly sunny. He took out his cell phone and unlocked it and called Lacey. Lacey, honey. He only called her honey when he was furious with her. Joe was all she got out. Then she was sobbing. His emotions whipsawed. Lacey was not a crier. His mother had been a crier, and he dated some girls who felt everything so keenly that tears were never far beneath the surface. But Lacey was not like that at all. He was suddenly scared, the anger roiling around, but unattached. What is it? More sobbing, then a deep breath. I saw the doctor. A long pause. Joe wanted to hang up, more than anything, because he knew that he was about to go through a door that led out of his life as it was and into a new, worse life. It was a door that only swung one way, and once you went through it, you could never go back. There was a split second when he actually almost hung up on Lacey, but of course, he didn't. It was stage 4 breast cancer, metastatic, nodules in her liver, pancreas, and one lung. Lacey had 3 months to live. 6 if they tried for the most extreme interventions. Lacey had stopped crying after the first 2 days and had become a laser-focused, stoic self-advocate who had read everything and even found a Dying with Dignity Facebook group that she'd become the queen bee of. She'd had all these picture books about kids whose parents were dying, and she read them regularly to Madison, snugging Maddie up on her lap and reading in the same quiet, sing-song, storytime cadence she'd always used at story time, as though she wasn't preparing their 6-year-old for a life without a mother. The doctor laid out all the ways that her 3 months could be lengthened to 6, and Lacey looked her straight in the eye and said, "If you had what I had, would you try any of those therapies?" The doctor pursed her lips. "Honestly, no. I don't think any doctor would." "Thank you for your honesty," is what Lacey said, and Joe knew then she wouldn't be doing anything else. Just because you've decided to die of cancer, that doesn't stop everyone you know from consuming your last months on this earth by sending you links to miracle cures. They deleted these and politely told everyone, even their parents, to cut that shit out. But people can't help themselves. Lacey's mom found the link to adoptive cell transfer therapy. It wasn't woo. The U.S. National Cancer Institute was part of the NIH, and they had gotten multiple papers on the therapy published in Nature, with huge numbers of citations. Joe and Lacey read the papers as best as they could, and Lacey talked about them with her dying Facebook friends, and they all decided maybe this was worth a shot. The way it worked was they sequenced the genome of your tumor and looked for traits that your own white blood cells could target. Then they sorted out your own white blood cells until they found some that targeted those traits and grew 100 billion or so of those little soldiers in a lab and injected them into you. It was just a way of speeding up the slow and inefficient process by which your own body tuned its own white blood cell population, giving it a computational boost that could outrace even the fastest mutating tumor. Joe and Lacey even found a private doc right there in Phoenix who'd do the procedure. He had an appointment at Arizona State University, had published some good papers on the procedure himself. All he needed was $1.5 million from them. From their health insurer. You know what happened next. Their insurer told Lacey that it was time for her to die now. If she wanted chemo and radiation and whatever, they'd pay for it, reluctantly and with great bureaucratic intransigence, but experimental therapies were not covered. Which, you know, okay, who wants to spend 1.5 mil on some charlatan's miracle cure juice cleanse or crystal therapy? But adaptive cell transfer wasn't crystal healing, and the NIH wasn't the local shaman. They underwent, or Joe underwent, a weird transformation after her last call with the supervisor at their insurer. Lacey had been so good about it all, finding peace and calm and determining to make her death a good death. She'd dragged Joe out of his anger at cancer and back into his love of her, and a mutual understanding that they'd make their last days together good ones. For them, and for Madison. But after the insurer turned them down, the rage came back. Maybe the therapy wouldn't have worked, but it was a chance, and a realistic one, not a desperate one, a real possibility that his daughter would have a mother, and that he would have a wife and best friend to grow old with. He wanted to sell the house and borrow more money from friends and family and do a GoFundMe, but Lacey wouldn't hear it. She pointed out that everything they and all their immediate families could spare wouldn't touch that $1.5 million ticket, and the only thing worse than a family losing its wife and mother was that same family losing its house and savings too. She was much smarter and much calmer than Joe. Joe was furious. Joe couldn't be angry at cancer, but he could be coldly, murderously enraged at an insurance company and the people who worked there. He worked for a blue-chip Fortune 100 company, and he'd bought the top tier of insurance, and they took more than $1,500 out of his paycheck every month for that coverage, and some faceless, evil fucker had just decided that they wouldn't even try to save his wife from a painful, grotesque death. The anger consumed Joe. He never rescheduled that meeting with the VP. He spent all his time writing to the HR department and the CFO, and when he wasn't doing that, he was literally crying in the toilet. And all the time, Lacey got sicker. Madison grew scared of Joe, shying away when he got home. They tried switching, so he was in charge of tucking her in, telling her a story, and singing the requisite three songs. She endured it, but it did nothing to reduce her obvious fear around him. "Babe," Lacey said, her equivalent to his honey. Joe knew he was in trouble. "You can't keep up like this. You're going to drop dead before I am, or shoot someone. You need to get help." Refusing chemo and radiation meant Lacey hadn't gotten thin, but the pain had been keeping her up nights, and she had a hollow, otherworldly, one-foot-in-the-grave look that he could barely stand. She took his face in her hands. "I'm not fooling, Joe. You get help, because if you don't get help, our baby girl is going to have zero parents, because you are headed for a mental institution, jail, or a courtroom defending your fitness to be a father." Her eyes burned into his. "I don't have a lot of strength or time to work on this with you, Joe. I know that normally finding a shrink or whatever would be my job in our division of labor, but you're going to have to step up. Am I making myself clear?" The words made Joe furious. The fury made Joe sad. He cried some, and then said, "You're right. I will." She gave him a long, long hug, and he went to the guest room and sat on the bed with his laptop and started Googling. He had 8 tabs worth of Yelp reviews for local shrinks open when he found the forum. Ostensibly, it was for fathers whose wives were dying of breast cancer. There are enough people dying of enough cancer that the forums had become that specialized. But actually, it was for fathers whose wives were dying of treatable breast cancer who'd been denied coverage by their insurers. Joe read for hours, long past the point when his butt went numb and he got a crick in his neck. The words on his screen seemed to come straight out of his own head. They were secret things, things he'd never dared say to any other human, because Lacey was right. They were the kinds of things that you couldn't say aloud without risking incarceration or involuntary commitment. Here were men saying those things, and other men who heard them and told them that they understood, that they had felt the same unspeakable feelings, and they understood those feelings. Even before he posted his first message to the forum, it had soothed something raw inside him, and maybe someday it could even heal the wounds that had been widening since his 36th birthday. He never bothered to find a shrink. He didn't need one. The fathers of the Fuck Cancer Right in Its Fucking Face forum were all the therapists he needed. The weeks went by, and everyone in their house came to understand that Joe's time in the guest room with his laptop were the reason that he had changed. No one resented the moments he stole there. Only an idiot really believes in spontaneous remission, which is, doctor, for your cancer went away and we don't know why. Oh, it happens, but so do lightning strikes and lottery jackpots. Spontaneous remission isn't a plan. It's an unrealistic daydream. Some people do get hit by lightning, though, and some people win the lottery. And Lacey got spontaneous remission. 3 months to live became 4, then 5, and her doctors started to make the most cautious preliminary noises about the nodules shrinking, and new tests, and then one day the doc summoned Lacey to her office, and Joe went along because when your doctor wants to discuss test results in person, it's better not to face that on your own. The doctor was running late, and that made Lacey and Joe run nervous, the tension stretching. It was an oncology practice, so the waiting room was full of bald, sunk-eyed, dying people and their haunted loved ones. And they were actually in better shape than the people who still looked well, because those people had just been diagnosed and were coming to the doctor to find out what happened next. Those people were wrecks. The nurse didn't bother taking Lacey's vitals, so she and Joe just waited in the exam room on a pair of orange waiting room chairs, holding hands tightly. The doctor came in and closed the door and apologized for making them wait, and made a joke about it being one of those days, and sat in her padded roller chair and squared up some papers on her desk. Then she looked at them both for a long moment and unexpectedly beamed at them. Lacey, Joe, I've been in practice for 14 years and I've given out a lot of bad news. I don't mind. It comes with the job. But it gets to you. Even when I have good news, it's still not happy news. We took out half your organs, removed your breasts, poisoned you, irradiated you, and now we think you are better. Sorry. But once in a very, very long while, a doctor in my job gets to give out good news. This is one of those days. She let that sink in. Lacey and Joe stared at each other. There were two words on the tips of their tongues, words they had never dared to utter without a sarcastic eye roll. They said the words now. Lacey starting, Joe joining in. Both of them tentative and questioning. Spontaneous? Remission? The doctor beamed at them. Joe cried before Lacey did. He always was the emotional one. But then Lacey cried. Then the doctor cried. And after Joe and Lacey had hugged for a long, long time, the doctor hugged Lacey. And then Joe. And then all three of them hugged. And Joe had nothing to say except, thank you, thank you, thank you. And everyone knew he wasn't exactly thanking the doctor. But no one was sure who he was thanking. Not even the doctor. Joe never did stop visiting Fuck Cancer right in its fucking face, which surprised him. That night, he and Lacey made the slowest, tenderest love in their entire relationship, fucking so slowly that they barely moved. Joe handled Lacey like she was made out of brittle china, and Lacey clung to Joe like he was the only thing keeping her from falling off the world's tallest building. Afterwards, they clung to each other, then moved apart, fingers twined. Before long, Lacey was sleeping, softly snoring, hogging the blankets, and Joe slipped out of bed and went back to the forum. There are lots of support forums online, and the best ones perform an incredible, nearly magical service for their participants, proving the aphorism that shared pain is lessened, shared joy is increased, and making the lives of everyone who contributes to them better. Fuck Cancer Right in Its Fucking Face was not one of those forums. Fuck Cancer Right in Its Fucking Face was a forum for very angry people whose loved ones were dying or dead. Some of the denizens of Fuckriff got better, maybe even partially due to the chance to vent in the forums, but also because they were surrounded by people who loved them and brought them back from the brink, people who shared their grief but had better coping skills. In a forum for ex-drunks, there's a big group of elder statespeople who've been sober for years and years. They're a wise, moderating voice, and they are the existence of proof of life after addiction. Whenever someone on the forums went on a bender and was recriminating with themselves, there was a dried-out elder who could tell a story to top theirs about being put out on the street, losing their kids, losing their limbs even, and coming back from it. Fuck Cancer Right in Its Fucking Face did not have those people. The people who got over their furious grief left Fuckriff, chased away by its rage culture. The people who stayed were really into their anger, clinging to it like a drunk refusing to let go of a bottle. If your anger took you to a place you couldn't handle, a place that scared you, the elders of Fuckriff would help you all right. They'd explain to you that this was the right reaction, the only reaction, and it was never ever going to get better. This was your life from here on in. When Lacey was pronounced well, Joe's anger drained out in an instant. The insurance flunkies who'd sentenced Lacey to die could stew in their juices and look themselves in the mirror every morning, and Joe would have his beautiful, brilliant wife and his amazing, sweet daughter, and that was all that mattered. But Fuckriff called to Joe. That first time he logged back in, he understood in a flash that for all that it had helped him, saved him, to see the thoughts from his own endless mental loops on the screen coming from other people, it would also have destroyed him. If Lacey had died, oh God, just the thought made his guts churn, this would have been his support system, and he would have taken the anchor they threw him and let it pull him right to the bottom of the ocean. Joe decided he had a duty to Fuckriff. He made the decision early on not to talk about his forum time with Lacey. She would probably understand, but she had enough to worry about. He mostly lurked anyway. He never picked fights with the great old ones who counseled despair and rage, but he'd private message the new ones who showed up all twisted and nuts and do his best to untwist them. He kept a list of suicide prevention numbers handy, and he gave a measured routine $20 to each GoFundMe that was posted to the forum. Even at that modest contribution level, there was one month when the family GoFundMe bill crossed the $500 mark and Lacey demanded to know what he was doing. He told a half-truth, saying it was for a friend's cancer fund, but not how many friends. Lacey couldn't be angry over that, but she gave him a stern talking to about their finances, and he agreed to cap the GoFundMe to $250 a month. She agreed to let him donate $300 in each election cycle to candidates who were pro-universal health care. He stayed on the forum. He was ready to quit Fuckriff, which old-timers like him called Fuckriff or Ruckfiff when they wanted to sound polite, when Lisa's dad 1990 joined. His first message: Lisa's 6 years old. This is what she looks like. I put her to bed every night since she stopped breastfeeding. I used to read her hand, fingers, thumb, and then we graduated Green Eggs. Now we're reading Harry Potter. That's right, a six-year-old. She's smart. Last year, Lisa started falling down a lot, bumping into things. Her teacher said she wasn't concentrating in school, and I saw it too. Her mom's not in the picture. I took her to the docs, and they said she had a brain tumor. I can go into details later, but it's not a good brain tumor. It's not little or cute. It's an aggressive little fucker, and it's growing. Lisa can only see out of one eye now, and she walks with a walker, or I wheel her in a chair. But the good news is that it's treatable. Not like 100%, but the oncologist says he can whack that bastard straight out of there and blast her with some rads and give her some poison and she'll live. She'll always have some problems, but she's young and she's full of life and she'll figure that shit out. But our insurance, not so much. I was working for a customs broker when it hit. My first real full-time job with insurance and everything. Paid so much into that insurance. So much. But they say the kind of surgery the doctor wants to do is experimental. They say it's not covered. Guys, I'm 28 years old, single dad. My parents haven't given me a dime since I told them to go fuck themselves and moved out at 17. If my ex had a dollar to spare, it'd go to Oxy's before the student debt collectors could get it. I have a GoFundMe, but that only works if you know a million people or one millionaire. My kid's the greatest thing in the world, but everyone thinks that about their kid, and from all the evidence so far, I'm the only one who can see it. Thing is, my daughter Lisa's going to die. I mean, I can kid myself about it, but that's what it's about. My six-year-old's going to die, even though she doesn't have to, or at least she has a chance she won't get a take. Because some random asshole earning $500,000 in an office at the top of a tower full of random assholes earning less than me decided she should die. He doesn't know her, and he won't ever know her, but he knows that there are so many kids like Lisa that are going to die because of his choices. Now, I've been sad. I've been angry. I've been worried. I hold Lisa so much, she tells me, Dad, stop it. But someday I'm going to hold her, and she won't say anything because she'll be dead. That's my truth in my life, and I live that truth every day. When Lisa goes, I'm going to go too. I never said that out loud, but I'll write it here because you guys know what I'm going through. I'm dead fucking serious. With Lisa, I had everything to live for. Now I got nothing. Can't even afford to bury her, not after all out of pockets. Red bills every day. Every credit card wants to send a guy around with a bat to break my knees. Maybe I'll buy a gun and shoot the first one that comes to the door and stick it in my mouth. Joe couldn't stop reading, but he wanted to. It was so raw, it brought him back to a dark place he thought he'd left behind. Trembling, he picked out a message with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, a number he'd memorized by now, 1-800-273-8255, and some numb words of comfort. It was the closest he'd ever come to talking about Lacey's spontaneous remission on Fuckriff, because he couldn't think of anything else to say, and that poor bastard needed some hope. But he deleted the sentences, and it sent. One message was published ahead of yours. Do it, wrote one of the great old ones. Seriously, do it. I'm going to do it someday when I'm all used up. Why shouldn't you? Why should these evil corporate fucks live when my wife is dead? When your kid's gonna die? I was gonna buy an AR-15 and do it, but fuck that. AR-15s are for people who want to shoot their way out, or people who need to shoot their way out. I don't need to do that. I'm an old middle-class white guy. I could walk right in, go right up to the top floor with a nice little fertilizer bomb and take out the whole fucking C-suite. Some innocents would die, but they're not all that innocent, are they? I grew up on a farm in Wyoming, and my dad had a book called The Blaster's Handbook that told you everything you needed to know about blowing shit up on an as-needed basis. Like if a horse dropped dead and froze solid and you needed to blast it into manageable chunks. The Blaster's Handbook has gone digital, and to save you the trouble of searching for it and getting on some kind of watch list, I'm attaching a copy of it here. You'd be amazed at how easy it is to make something that'll go boom. Hell, my old man was simple as fuck, and he managed it. All I'm saying is, if you're going to do something drastic, don't let it go to waste. He signed with his screen name, Death Eater, which Joe had been staring at for years, but never really had thought about until just then. Jesus, Death Eater. Joe hit reply and then stopped himself. What did you say to something like that? Should he call the cops? The guy who started the message board, Big Ted, barely ever logged in anymore, but Joe had his email address somewhere from when he'd locked himself out of his account once. He decided that was probably his first port of call, so he pasted Death Eater's message into an email. Just as he sent it, he had a moment's twizzle as he thought about what kind of bot might scan that email between him and Big Ted, what kind of watch list he might be putting himself on. He stayed off the thread, but other fuckriffers jumped in. Some of them were scolding and moralizing, calling Death Eater a monster or pretending he'd been kidding and telling him off for making a joke in such poor taste. Others ran with the joke, spinning more and more elaborate scenarios of mass mayhem. Lots of them posted screenshots from the Blaster's Handbook, talked about ways to improve on the design, wrapping the package in duct tape, adding washer nuts and ball bearings for shrapnel. A very few users talked to Lisa's dad in 1990 about his daughter, offering him the kind of comfort Joe had tried for. Lisa's dad in 1990 didn't reply to any of them. Big Ted closed the thread the next day and gave Death Eater a 3-day timeout. Lisa's dad in 1990 went silent. Joe private messaged him a couple of times, but mostly he forgot about it. Madison turned 7. They had ice cream cake and played games and finished with a sleepover with her best friend from across the street, Rose, who wet the bed at 12 a.m. and woke them both up in floods of humiliated tears. Lacey got Rose cleaned up, and Joe sorted out the mattress, putting a trash bag over the wet spot, then putting fresh sheets over that. Lacey went right back to sleep, and so did Rose. Joe couldn't sleep. He padded to the guest room with his laptop and started fuck-riffing. "She died today," Lisa's dad, 1990, wrote. "I'm sorry about all the mess my last message made. I was in a low place. But I want to thank you all for weighing in, even the ones who joked and whatnot. I even laughed at some of that. It kept me going. All of it. We're burying her tomorrow." The timestamp was only 6 minutes gone. Joe private messaged him. "If you need to talk, I'm up." He stared at the screen for a long time, waiting for a pop-up, hitting refresh, hoping Lisa's dad, 1990, would reply. Minutes dragged by. He tabbed over to Facebook and skimmed, tabbed back. He looked up the estimated arrival of an Amazon box he just remembered he was expecting. He took a quick glance over his Gmail spam folder, which he tried to do every month before flushing it. He was about to close his laptop or possibly about to start doing all this all over again when a reply popped up. "Thanks. It's not a good night. Funeral's next week. Put it on my last credit card. Gonna be a real send-off." "That sounds like a worthy thing to use that card for, but how are you holding up?" "Put it this way, I don't plan on paying that credit card bill." Joe's stomach sank. "I know I sent you the suicide crisis number before, but here it is again, 1-800-273-8255, or You just text HOME to 741741 and someone will be there. Both are 24/7. I call that number. It was nice of you to send it to me. I can tell you're the kind of person who wants everyone to have hope. That's a nice kind of person to be. Lisa was that kind of person. That was all she could talk about. Kid just turned 7 and all she could say was, Daddy, you gotta have hope. You're going to be okay. She wanted me to watch Annie, if you can believe it. Stupid Netflix. That actually made Joe laugh involuntarily. Chuckle, really. He got the feeling that he and Lisa's dad, 1990, would probably enjoy each other's company. She was right. He took a deep breath. Look, where are you? Maybe you and I could get together. I'm in Phoenix. Not me. I live in Cow's Asshole, South Carolina, but that's nice of you. Well, how about a phone call? I could crack a beer. You could crack a beer. We could have a beer together. You're a nice guy, I can tell, but thank you for that. I'll take a rain check. Then he logged off. Joe didn't think he'd be able to sleep that night, but he was a man, a human being approaching middle age, and human beings need sleep, and so he slept. The next day was Sunday, his day to cook breakfast. He managed to get all the way through it with Madison and her friend, whose nocturnal embarrassment had been dissipated by a few more hours' sleep and a set of laundered PJs, without thinking to check the news out of South Carolina or the posts on Fuckriff. But once Rose's slightly mortified parents had picked her up and Madison was in a room making slime and watching YouTube, he got out his phone and Google News searched South Carolina suicide. The search results were empty. Of course, Lisa's dad, 1990, wouldn't do it until the funeral was over. Joe had all week to talk him down. Work was never the same for Joe after Lacey got sick. He never rescheduled that meeting with the VP. He just couldn't muster the fucks needed to give it his all for on-demand wholesale distribution. People he'd started with left to work for experimental divisions, doing partnerships with self-driving forklift companies, or diving into cloud-based self-serve platforms for commerce dropshippers, or all that other stuff that helped people get their squatty potties and strobing LED USB chargers delivered to their doors with 5 nines of reliability. Joe settled into his cubicle and did exactly the things in his job description and clocked out at 5 o'clock p.m. every single day. He had a work phone and a personal phone, and he'd had lots of training about the fact that the work phone's traffic was all logged, even the secure traffic, because the company'd done something to its operating system so everything he did with it would be visible to the compliance team. They had to do it, they said, for their insurance. It was important, therefore, that he strictly segregate his personal activities and work-related activities. No one wanted to read his sexts or eavesdrop on his search history when he was coping with an embarrassing itch. This had been real struggle with Joe at first because he was the kind of guy who liked to pull the handle on his work email slot machine, checking to see whether his boss wanted him to do stuff after hours. That meant the phone he was most likely to have in his hand at any given moment was the work phone. Sometimes he even forgot to charge his personal phone. But then after his company's HR department told him it wasn't their job to stop his wife from being murdered by their health insurer, he got demotivated. Now it was his work phone that was usually out of battery. So at the office he used his personal phone to check in with Lisa's dad, 1990. He'd read fuck yous about what to say to suicidal people and he was working his way through the list. Lisa's dad, 1990, didn't always respond, but he responded sometimes, and that meant he was listening, and that meant Joe wasn't going to give up. The days ticked by until Lisa's funeral. Lisa's dad, 1990, posted photos from the funeral, sad photos of weeping relatives, his snaggletooth, ravaged attic deck ex included, pics of the tiny casket, the urn, the ashes. The men of Fuckrift were respectful and solemn about these pictures. They had a thing they did when they wanted to perform their solemnity, posting a message with just a single space character so it looked blank, like words fail me. The photos had a massive trail of these. But Death Eaters had another copy of the Blaster's handbook attached to it. Lisa's dad, 1990, didn't answer any more of Joe's private messages. Joe told himself he was just wisely taking some time away from Fuck Griff's seductive, toxic environment and taking comfort from real-world friends who were less violence-obsessed. But Joe found himself pulling out his personal phone and searching for bombing in South Carolina almost automatically any time he let his thoughts wander. It was the end of May, and Madison was graduating from second grade, and the school was making a big deal out of it. Joe had missed the kindergarten and first grade versions of the ceremony, but he no longer had the burning ambition that made it so hard to ask for half days off for personal time. He got in his car at lunchtime and drove to the school, stopping to buy a lei and a Mylar balloon from a Mexican guy who was walking the line of parents waiting outside the auditorium with a pushcart, admonishing them to show your kids how proud you are of them and how important their education is to you. The pitch was pretty naked, but it still skewered Joe in some deep, guilty parenting instinct. Lacey beat him there and saved him a seat, and they held hands while the kids gave speeches about their dreams for the future and sang songs and made tributes to their teachers. The kids were plenty cute in their little dresses and suits, but it got pretty repetitive, and Joe twitched his phone out of his pocket and discreetly ran his search. Normally, South Carolina bombing returned a bunch of pages on the Mars Bluff B-47 nuclear incident when the United States Air Force accidentally nuked the town of Mars Bluff in 1958. Today, the top of the listing was a series of Google News links to a story about an explosion at the Columbia headquarters of Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina. The singing on stage and the bored whispering and shifting of the parents around him vanished instantly and totally, and his vision tunneled down to his screen. He tapped a link for an AP story, and Lacey hissed at him to put his phone away, and he started guiltily and looked up, but he couldn't focus his eyes. "Go into the bathroom," he whispered, and made his way down to the aisle, threading between parents' knees and the seat backs in front of them, stumbling, then into the school hall hung with art and poetry, into the boys' bathroom with its miniature urinals and the scarred stalls. He stepped into one and read the AP story. It was light on details, just a breaking news piece, but the facts were devastating. An explosion had gone off at the Blue Cross Blue Shield headquarters. Police suspected terrorism. There were 10 confirmed dead already, and the strong presumption that that number would go way up as the rescue team sorted through the rubble. The pictures of the building were sickening. Like a rotten tooth, a huge hole had been blasted through the upper story walls, spanning 3 floors. The jerky cam images ganked from Twitter were all smoke and fire and stumbling, bleeding people in office clothes. He stood there in the stall for God knew how long, staring at his phone, wishing he had never pulled it out, wishing that this was a senseless mystery for him instead of an event that was not mysterious in the slightest. He should call the cops. He really should just go call the cops. There was noise from outside the bathroom, crowd sounds. Then the door to the boys' room banged open and kids' voices filled it. He pocketed his phone and ran out of the bathroom, barely hearing a smart-alecky kid calling after him to wash his hands. Lacey walked him to his car after they'd had their pictures taken with Madison and given her her balloons and lei and seen her off with a friend's mom to go back to their place for a movie and popcorn party. "What is it?" He wasn't going to tell her, of course. Jesus, bad enough he was in this. "You know that message board?" She rolled her eyes. She did not approve of Fuckriff. I know, but there's a guy there who's having a really hard time. His daughter, same age as Maddie, and I just want to be there for him. They were there for me when I needed it, and I'm paying that forward." She rolled her eyes again, but pulled him into a long hug. You're a good man, Joseph Gorman. Just remember, you can't carry the world on your shoulders, and you have a family who need you, too. Don't spend everything you've got on strangers. Thank you, Lacey. I know, it's good advice. I try to keep it all in perspective, but you know. I know. Of course I know. That's why I'm reminding you. You've got a big heart, and you need help caring for it. I married into that job. She gave him a longer hug this time, squeezing him fiercely with all the strength that had returned to her body since their miracle. Even as he was noticing this, he was thinking of the phone in his pocket and wondering where he could pull over and get online and read the news reports and log into Fuckriff. Lisa's dad, 1990, posted a video explaining what he was doing, but thankfully he didn't mention Fuckriff. Even so, everyone on Fuckriff was tense as hell, and there was a lot of going back and deleting stuff until the cops announced that Lisa's dad, 1990, had used Tor browser extensively and had left behind no browser breadcrumbs nor any records at AT&T's data centers. Inevitably, this set off a whole witch hunt over the dark web, everyone wondering where the mystery man from the video had been, quote-unquote, radicalized. Lisa's dad, 1990, was a soft-spoken, slightly heavy-set man with sad eyes and a three-day beard. In the video, he spoke in a monotone, staring straight into the camera with red-rimmed eyes. His hair was limp and greasy, and the kitchen behind him was in chaos, with empty pharmacy packaging and pizza boxes. In a quiet, calm, gentlemanly southern voice, he talked about the decision that Blue Cross Blue Shield had made to deny his daughter's coverage and what that had meant. He held up a photo of a smiling little girl, brown pixie cut, missing tooth, a dusting of freckles on a little upturned nose. He talked about Lisa's stories, the drawing she'd do to accompany them, the kitten she'd rescued and nursed to health, her inconsolable grief when the cat was hit by a car. He talked about her illness and her bravery and her pain and her promise. He spoke extemporaneously, no notes in evidence, and when he was done, he stopped for a long time, then wiped his eyes with his thumbs, opened and shut his mouth a few times without being able to speak, drew in a deep, shuddering breath, and composed himself. So, that's why I'm doing this. It's not vengeance. I don't have a ventral bone in my body. Nothing I do will bring Lisa back, so why would I want revenge? This is a public service. There's another dad just like me and another little girl just like... Another moment to compose himself. Just like Lisa. Right now, that dad's talking to someone at Cigna or Humana, or Blue Cross Blue Shield, and the person on the phone is telling that dad that his little girl has to die. Someone in that building made the decision to kill my little girl, and everyone else in that building went along with it. Not one of them is innocent. Not one of them is afraid. They're going to be afraid after this. After today, every one of those people is going to spend the rest of their lives looking over their shoulders for a man like me. Ordinary looking, harmless, a little sad, maybe, because they must know in their hearts, them, their lobbyists, the men in Congress who enable them, their parents, they know, anyone who hurt their precious children, they'd hunt that person down like a dog. The only amazing thing about any of this is that no one has done it yet. I'm going to make a prediction right now that even though I'm the first, I sure as hell will not be the last. There's more to come. To those fathers and husbands, mothers and wives, grandparents and lovers, the ones who come after me, I want to salute you. We're going to scare them. We're going to make them so scared they'll never get a night's sleep again. They'll right this wrong, this stain on our country, not because they love your kids. Not as much as you love your kids, but because we'll scare them into it. He stared into the camera for a while longer, his eyes burning and glittering. Then he nodded to himself, stood up, and walked out of the frame. When he came back a moment later, he had a duct tape package the size of a pot roast that he carefully lifted and placed into a backpack. He nodded once more, shrugged into the backpack, and clicked the video off. It occurred to Joe that even though Lisa's dad 1990, his name was Saul, but Joe thought of him as Lisa's dad 1990, still talks so much about fear, no one on TV or in the news mentioned terrorism. There were some Twittery types who pointed out that Lisa's dad 1990 had the wrong color skin to be a terrorist, and instead he was not right in his head, or mentally ill, or even traumatized. Not even the families of the people killed in the Columbia explosion used the T word, though plenty called him a murderer and a monster and worse. But certainly, none of the fuckriffers wanted to whisper the T word. There was a furious debate that danced around the T word about when it was okay to spout off and fantasize about violence and when that crossed the line. Big Ted might have had a view on this, but 24 hours after Lisa's dad, 1990, killed all those people and himself, Big Ted announced that he was going to stop administering fuckriff and that he'd pass the torch to Death Eater, who had the time and energy to give it the attention it deserved. Once Death Eater was the lord and master of fuckriff, the debate ended. Death Eater declared that there was only one way to be a fuckriffer, and that was to meet grief in all of its guises, including rage, to be authentic and true to yourself. Death Eater also announced that the majority of the boards on fuckriff were moving to a tour hidden service that they'd need to a tour hidden service that they need Tor browser to read, and set up a complicated protocol to let them claim their existing IDs on the fuckriff in the dark, which is what the new service was called. Joe ignored this for a while. He was even secretly relieved. If all the worst of the worst of the broken fuckriffers disappeared into the dark, then he could hang around on the nub that was still visible on the open web and play fairy godfather and Jiminy Cricket to the people who weren't beyond help. But Death Eater was determined to suck as many souls into the dark as he could. Any time a thread really got going on fuckriff, he'd close it and announce that it had moved to the dark. The newbies would follow him there. The third time this happened, Joe realized that Death Eater maintained fuckriff as a gateway drug to the dark. The dark was fuckriff. Once he figured that out, Joe was done with fuckriff. He parked his account and walked away from it. The second bomber went after a Tennessee Republican state senator who'd voted down the Medicare expansion despite his campaign promise to make sure that every Tennessean who wants insurance will get insurance. The bomber was named Logan Lentz, and his people had been in Tennessee since it became a state in 1796. Though his background was wealthy, he was broke. His parents had lost the family fortune when he was a boy, and he'd had been a scholarship case at TSU, where six generations of his ancestors had matriculated, and he'd been the president of the Phi Beta Sigma, like his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had been. Logan Lentz was the widower of Patricia Lentz, another Tennessean of long and fallen lineage whose uterine cancer was treatable, according to her OBGYN, or not, according to Cigna's insurance underwriters. Patricia lost a baby early in the cancer, which everyone secretly counted as a blessing, what with her illness and all, and when she died a year later at the age of 26, Logan had been shattered. Logan bombed Senator William Blunt's office on a fine Saturday after a day's worth of constituency meetings during the spring recess. I'm going to stop right there. You want to hear the rest of the story? Tune in next year. And until then, make sure to pay your health insurance premiums. And Have a happy solstice. Put aside all the dread of the past. And light a candle. Black or white.